Welcome to the 21st episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Brandon Scalia. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. On October 25th, we travel to Stanford for a State of the Science Summit on ovarian cancer and soft tissue sarcoma. At the meeting, faculty from Stanford Medicine discussed advances made in the treatment landscapes, touching on available modalities such as immunotherapy, antibody drug conjugates, and PARP inhibitors. Although developments have been made in each therapy class, the most recent to make headlines are PARP inhibitors. In November 2018, the FDA granted a priority review designation to a supplemental new drug application for olaparib based on data from the Phase 3 SOLO-1 trial. The application was submitted for use as a maintenance therapy in patients with newly diagnosed BRCA-positive advanced ovarian cancer who achieved a complete or partial response to standard frontline platinum-based chemotherapy. At 41 months of follow-up, the median progression-free survival by independent central review had not yet been reached in patients who received frontline maintenance with olaparib versus 14.1 months in those who received placebo. The FDA is scheduled to make its decision on the application by the end of the first quarter of 2019. Kicking off the night, Peter Lavonian, MS, a senior genetic counselor at Stanford Medicine, spoke to the importance of genetic testing following a diagnosis of ovarian cancer. Although genetic testing can help steer a patient's course of treatment, there are still many misconceptions that have impeded its widespread adoption and practice. Lavonian addressed these misconceptions and emphasized how the hereditary nature of ovarian cancer impacts testing.
One of the things that I think is important is that what's been recognized in recent years is that every patient with a diagnosis of epithelial ovarian cancer should be seen for a genetic consultation. We generally say that it should be non-mucinous epithelial ovarian cancer, but honestly, a genetics program would always be happy to see any patient with a diagnosis of ovarian cancer. And the reason for that is because we've realized that ovarian cancer, more than many other cancers, has a significant proportion of cases that have a strong hereditary basis, even if there's no family history. Many times patients who have no family history will wonder, well, how could it possibly be hereditary in my case? And there can be several reasons for that, not least of which is that we have to remember that genes that can cause a susceptibility to ovarian cancer and other cancers can be inherited from the father's side of the family just as easily as the mother's side of the family. And of course, in a father, we're not going to see a diagnosis of ovarian cancer, but a gene that predisposes to that condition can be passed down through the paternal lineage. When working with any family with ovarian cancer, it's helpful to know the family history, and it's always important to ask about the father's side of the family just as importantly as the mother's side of the family. And sometimes there can be clues in the pattern of cancers in the family that can tell us if it's more or less likely to be hereditary. And if there are some indicators that it may be hereditary, sometimes the family history can guide us to certain genes that might explain the pattern.
Next, we sat down with Elizabeth Diver, MD, who is a clinical assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Stanford Medicine. Diver testified to the value of PARP inhibitors in the space, especially for patients with BRCA mutations. Although PARP inhibitors have been effective as single agents, she noted several combination trials that are coming down the pike, which are likely to extend their reach in practice.
So for niraparib today, we're going to talk about the FDA-approved indication for niraparib, which is for maintenance after platinum-containing chemotherapy for platinum-sensitive ovarian cancer based on the NOVA trial. This trial was really important for us in ovarian cancer management, as we showed benefit of the PARP inhibitors in all women with ovarian cancer, regardless of BRCA, germline, or somatic status. For olaparib, the most exciting update we have is the new data that just came out this week with the SOLO-1 trial. And so we're going to review today the new findings demonstrating a dramatic progression-free survival benefit after upfront chemotherapy for women with germline BRCA mutations. At ESMO, we saw the first progression-free survival curves come from SOLO-1. And in this trial, we showed that the median progression-free survival for women with germline BRCA 1 and 2 after upfront treatment on olaparib was not yet reached, but 60% of them were still disease-free at 3 years. I think that this is going to be the beginning of practice-changing care for us in ovarian cancer management, and we're going to see that women with germline BRCA are going to start receiving maintenance therapy after upfront chemo.
Next, we spoke with Jonathan S. Barrick, MD, MMS, who explained that PARP inhibitors have made the biggest splash thus far in the field. Barrick is the Laurie Krause Professor at Stanford Medicine, Director of the Stanford Women's Cancer Center, and Senior Advisor at Stanford Cancer Institute. In his presentation, he echoed Livonian and Diver's statements on the value of genetic testing and the impact that PARP inhibitors have on the field.
Yeah, I mean, the risk factors are for developing the disease are, first of all, if one carries a germline mutation that predisposes, which is now something that we can detect better than we used to be able to detect based on, to some extent, on family history, but also we're just testing more and more people. We're testing everybody who comes to the center with ovarian cancer diagnosis for any genetic background so that they have that information in terms of their potential treatment with PARP inhibitors or so that they can advise their family. But the treatments vary to some extent based on the different types of histology. At this point, there's probably not enough specific targeted therapy to allocate based on that. We do treat, for example, mucinous tumors different. There's beginning to be an effort to treat endometrioid clear cell somewhat different, and we're treating low-grade serous carcinomas different than we do high-grade. High-grade serous carcinomas make up about 85% of all the ovarian fallopian tube cancers, and they're the ones that are responsive to PARP inhibitors.
Although several remain in development, Diana English, MD, a gynecologic oncologist at Stanford Hospital and Clinics, explained that antibody drug conjugates may be the next class of novel therapies to emerge for patients with ovarian cancer. The furthest in development is mirvetuximab soravtansine, she said, and it is currently being tested in the Phase 3 FORWARD trial. In this study, mirvetuximab soravtansine is being compared with investigators' choice of chemotherapy in patients with platinum-resistant disease.
I think the most promising would be some of the antibody drug conjugates that are already in Phase 3 trials. And one in particular is an antibody drug conjugate that targets the folate receptor alpha. It's called mirvetuximab soravtansine. And this antibody drug conjugate has the antibody that's specific to the folate receptor alpha. It's linked to a cytotoxic agent, which is actually an antimicrotubular agent, and this is DM4. And the specificity of the antibody recognizing that antigen, the folate receptor alpha, allows it to hopefully target tumor cells that tend to have a high expression of this folate receptor alpha. And I want to give you some numbers here. So about 80% of ovarian cancers overexpress folate receptor alpha, and about 60% of ovarian cancers express it at high levels. So anywhere from 50 to 75% of tumor cells with intense staining, meaning greater than 2+ staining on immunohistochemistry. And in the population of patients that are even platinum resistant, that are less heavily pretreated, so less than 3 prior lines, this drug has actually shown some very meaningful and very promising results with objective response rates in the order of 39%. And it's now being looked at in a Phase 3 clinical trial. This is called the FORWARD-1 clinical trial and is being compared to physician's choice, again, in platinum-resistant ovarian cancer. And the typical single agents that we use in platinum-resistant ovarian cancer include Doxil, topotecan, Taxol, and is compared to one of those physician choice drugs. the typical single agents used in platinum-resistant ovarian cancer really have response rates mostly in the order of 10 to 15%. So this drug does, this antibody-drug conjugate does seem to hold promise. The other ADCs are targeting other antigens or proteins that are overexpressed in ovarian cancer, one of them being mesothelin, and this is expressed in the majority of ovarian cancers. And there's an ADC called anetumab ravtansine that is targeting the mesothelin protein, and this antibody drug conjugate is conjugated as well to the same antimicrotubular agent DM4. But again, there's a specificity of recognizing the mesothelin, which is overexpressed in ovarian cancer cells, and did show some promise in ovarian cancer, but honestly, there are more meaningful results in mesothelioma. So there is a phase 2 clinical trial that's looking at this drug, this antibody drug conjugate, in combination with bevacizumab versus bevacizumab and paclitaxel in platinum-resistant disease. However, as I said before, the most reassuring and promising results really have been in mesothelioma.
Although antibody drug conjugates have garnered a lot of excitement in the field, immunotherapy as a whole has had less of an impact on patients, explained co-chair Oliver Dorigo, MD, PhD. Dorigo is associate professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Stanford University Medical Center. When we sat down with Dorigo, he explained where immunotherapy stands in development, and he shed light on the combinations that hold the highest chance of synergy.
Immunotherapy for ovarian cancer is being investigated now in many clinical trials and has already shown some very promising efficacy in certain patients. Immunotherapy in ovarian cancer is not a new concept, and we have been pursuing this for many decades now. Early trials have shown, for example, that tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes or white blood cells that are extracted from patients' ovarian cancer tumor then expanded in cell culture outside the patient's body in a laboratory and then reinfused into the patient can actually have some very significant clinical under-tumor activities. These type of cell therapy studies are now being modified. We have genetic modification techniques that allow us to make these white blood cells in particular T cells more specific to recognize the cancer cells and remain active in an otherwise very immunosuppressive microenvironment of ovarian cancer. What we have so far observed in clinical trials in ovarian cancer using so-called immune checkpoint inhibitors as single agents, a response rate between 10 and 15%, and patients up to 30, 35% have benefited from these type of approaches with stable disease and have overall done very well. We need to further increase the efficacy of these type of therapies by modifying our approaches, by potentially combining immune checkpoint inhibitors with other drugs. Promising efficacy in clinical trials, at least the early data, has been generated from combining immune checkpoint inhibitors with PARP inhibitors. And we have seen that patients, even outside of BRCA2 mutations, can have very significant under-tumor responses combining PARP inhibition with immune checkpoint inhibition. These studies have to be expanded. We have to learn much more about what patients are good candidates for immunotherapy. We currently do have certain ideas on what we could potentially use as a predictor for immune therapy in the patient's tumor and also in the patient's blood. But these studies need to be extended to more patients. We need to learn much more what patients are ideal for immunotherapy versus other therapies.
As these novel approaches continue to surface, people have begun to question the relevance of surgery in the paradigm, especially with the emergence of neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Although neoadjuvant chemotherapy is thought to reduce the burden of disease in patients who are too ill or frail to undergo upfront surgery, there are no robust data to prove the approach's superiority. Amer Karam, MD, co-chair and associate clinical professor of gynecologic oncology at Stanford Hospital and director of robotic surgery and outreach in the Division of Gynecologic Oncology at Stanford Medicine, took to the stage to emphasize the role of surgery in the treatment of patients with advanced ovarian cancer, breaking down the selection criteria for patients for whom each approach is most important.
You know, for almost a century now, the concept of surgery for advanced ovarian cancer, particularly advanced stage ovarian cancer, centered around surgical debulking or cytoreduction. And the concept of leaving as little as possible in terms of residual disease as a result of surgery for advanced stage ovarian cancer. So our goal was to be able to remove as much as possible of the cancer, and over the years that has involved using more and more radical techniques, particularly ultra-radical surgery in the upper abdomen. The other concept that has started to be put forward is the concept of neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So basically, patients who are too ill or have such an overwhelming burden of disease, giving these patients neoadjuvant chemotherapy in order to reduce their disease burden and in order to allow them to heal or to get stronger before they undergo surgery to remove remove cancer from their abdomen. In the United States, at least in our division, we think that primary debulking surgery should be or upfront surgery should be the standard of care for those patients who can undergo surgery. And we do believe in the concept of microscopic residual disease as being the goal of our surgeries. For those patients, again, who cannot go through upfront debulking surgery, who are too ill or too frail or have disease that is too overwhelming, then those patients should be offered neoadjuvant chemotherapy.
Representing systemic treatment of soft tissue sarcoma for uterine leiomyosarcoma was Christian Ganju, MD, an associate professor of medicine at Stanford University Medical Center. Although sarcomas are extremely rare, composing only 5% of all carcinomas, there are several treatment options available for patients with both early stage and metastatic disease. When Ganju sat down with us, she shed light on the presentation and treatment of uterine leiomyosarcomas.
Most common types of cancers are carcinomas, and about 5% of them are sarcomas. And out of the sarcomas, there are three main types. One of them is a leiomyosarcoma, which is the most common, and then the other is undifferentiated sarcoma, and then endometrial stromal sarcomas. So three types of sarcomas in the uterus. There are about 5,000 cases of uterine sarcomas in the U.S. every year. The treatment that can possibly cure them is surgery. So early diagnosis is extremely important. If it's metastatic, then it becomes incurable. Usually it's in younger women, and a lot of them are diagnosed as having fibroids, and fibroids are a benign form of smooth muscles, so they're leiomyomas or fibroids. And when they're discovered, there's usually the tumor growing and the abdominal mass shows, and then there's bleeding, and at that point there's metastatic disease. Some of the other patients who are presumed to have fibroids, they have a procedure called morcellation, where the uterus is broken into parts and then they're suctioned out. And at the end of the day, they discover that it's really a leiomyosarcoma and everything spreads in the abdomen. So out of 350 patients who have a fibroid, one would have a leiomyosarcoma. So out of those patients who have a morcellation, they almost all spread and recur.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to the 21st episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have two upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you'd like to review the latest data to come from the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, we will be in Nashville, Tennessee on January 14th for a State of the Science Summit on breast cancer. We will also be holding a State of the Science Summit on gastrointestinal malignancies on January 29th in Pasadena, California. Register now at onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.